And I'm pretty convinced that, you know, if anyone can manage an energy transition, it will be the Germans.
Hello, and welcome back to the Climate Bridge podcast. My name is Toby Bernstein, and I'm an advisor at the Berlin-based think tank Adelphi, where I co-lead the program office of the Transatlantic Climate Bridge, the initiative behind this podcast.
Hello, and I'm Lena Kois, member of Polis 180, a young grassroots think tank on European and foreign policy, and a partner institution of the Transatlantic Climate Bridge. Beside my voluntary work at Polis, I'm currently doing a master's at the University of Konstanz. And together with Toby, I am hosting today's episode.
The goal of the Transatlantic Climate Bridge and of this podcast is to promote climate cooperation between Germany, the United States, and Canada. Stay tuned through the end of the episode to learn more about the Transatlantic Climate Bridge. Lena and I are really excited about this episode. We spoke to Kansas State Representative Tobias Schlingensiepen. Tobias had recently joined a study tour organized by the Transatlantic Climate Bridge, which invited seven state legislators from the US and Canada to come to Germany to learn more about Germany's energy transition, or the Energiewende. We chatted with him about the intersection of climate and agricultural policy, transatlanticism, bipartisan policymaking, and also post-apocalyptic movies.
And at the end, we asked him about his policy crush, so stay tuned to hear that and the rest of the conversation.
So a warm welcome from my side to Kansas State Representative Tobias Schlingensiepen. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
We want to start with some background questions. So it'd be great if you could tell me a little bit about yourself, how you came to work in politics generally, but also on energy and environment more specifically, and what you were doing before representing Kansas's 55th district, and maybe also any transatlantic connections you might have.
So I guess we could start at the beginning. I grew up in a German family. I was born in West Berlin in 1963, 2 days after John F. Kennedy's assassination. And my parents came to the United States because my father was doing postdoctoral work after receiving his medical doctorate at the University of Berlin, at the Freie Uni Berlin. And we came to the United States and lived first in Ann Arbor and quickly came to Kansas, where I grew up since I was 3.5 years old. I spent every summer in Germany living with my grandparents, both in West Germany and in East Germany. Mostly centered in the Rhineland in the west and around Halle and Naumburg and Saale in the east. And so it was an interesting perspective on life for 3 months out of every year. Well, I sort of come from a political family, I guess you could say. We've always been very historically interested. We've had several people in the family who've been involved in politics. An uncle of mine was a diplomat, a German diplomat, and served in various places from Lima to Moscow, to Damascus, where he finally retired. And a great grandfather of mine was a chancellor of Germany for 100 days. so there's some politics in the family, but I got involved in politics actually. I'm a theologian and a pastor in the United Church of Christ, and I used to be the head of what's called the UEK Forum. The Union Evangelischer Kirchen, we in the United Church of Christ have a partnership, and I was in charge of facilitating Landeskirchen to Landeskirchen, conference to Landeskirchen partnerships between our churches. And we've done a lot of things together with youth exchanges and with other kinds of things over the years. And so I'm a pastor at First Congregational Church in Topeka, Kansas, and I got involved in politics when Governor Sam Brownback back in 2011, as the first thing after getting elected, decided to announce that he wanted to close the Kansas Neurological Institute, which is a hospital of our most severely disabled fellow Kansans. And I organized a group of clergy, interfaith clergy, to go and ask the question, so what's the plan for the residents there? And there was no plan. And so we protested that this hospital should be shut as part of a plan to finance tax breaks for the wealthy by cutting social services, and especially to people who had lived there for 30, 40 years and were living in neighborhood situations that were quite modern and very, very good. And so we ultimately prevailed against the governor, and that sort of launched me into politics. I was asked to run for Congress back in 2012. Somebody had to lose, and I was the one chosen to do it. And then I ran again for the Senate seat that had been occupied by our governor, our current governor, Laura Kelly. That was the year that Trump ran for office, and Democrats were trampled underfoot, and so I lost that one too. And I had the good fortune of, however, having won handily the House district in which I now sit during that Senate race. And so when Representative Annie Keither decided to retire from her service to Kansas in the House, she called and let me know that she was retiring and would endorse me if I ran. So my team had worked very hard 2 years before and was very hopeful. And so we said, yes, let's do it. And so fortunately, I made it in. And so this is my first 2 year stint.
It's amazing. It's not only perhaps a rite of passage, but also a lot of hard work that went into it. And the connection to climate and energy with your current committee placement as well on the energy and utilities?
So my predecessor was in the House Committee for Energy, Utilities, and Telecommunications, as it's called, for 26 years, and has just been made a commissioner for the Kansas Corporation Commission, which regulates utilities here in Kansas. And so she has a long and distinguished history of being a member of that committee. I was fortunate to be able to succeed her in that committee, which meant that I had someone to learn from. So it's an area, of course, it's fairly new to me. I'm certainly no energy expert. However, sort of funny, I've always been environmentally concerned. With 8 years, I wrote an essay for a newspaper about the quick demise of various species on the planet, and it was published. And so my father was an ethologist, so that meant he studied animal behavior and knew such people as Konrad Lorenz and Karl von Frisch and people like that back in the day, and Gregory Bateson and others. And so I grew up in a scientific family and one that was concerned with the plight of the world given kind of ruthless human exploitation. And so so that's always been a part of my existence. And we've spent a lot of time camping and out in the woods and things of that nature. So so there's that side. But actually, when I was 13, Kansas decided to build a nuclear power plant, its first, at Wolf Creek. And I wrote letters to the governor, to senators, to my congressional people opposing the building of that nuclear power plant, to no avail. So you could say at 13, I was already sort of an advocate for clean energy.
So speaking of your advocacy, maybe, what do you think are the biggest energy and climate challenges that Kansas is facing today? And what exactly is being done to address them?
So I think, you know, one of the things that certainly we can talk about is water. So what we have done in Kansas particularly is we have just passed a water bill. That has been something we have been trying to work on for over a quarter century. You may be aware, Kansas, probably the westernmost quarter of the state, is underlain by the Oglala Aquifer, which is an enormous source of underground water. We have rapidly been depleting it over the decades. I remember already in junior high school hearing about its limited reserves, but now we are really entering a period in which many of the regions that lie above the aquifer, we might have 5 to 10 years left of water, and then that's it. And it's hard to describe what the aquifer is. It's a kind of a Swiss cheese of underground caverns. The geological stratigraphy is quite complex. In some areas, because of the extraction of water, the ground has collapsed. And there's no question that there will ever be any replenishment in those areas. And in any event, it's taken, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of years to fill up those reservoirs. And once they're depleted, they are, for all practical purposes, depleted. So we were able to pass a water bill that puts, you know, restrictions on the kind of amount of water that can be extracted, that also provides matching state funds for federal dollars that can be used for example, technology that makes water usage more efficient for farmers and other agri-producers out there. There's a lot of cattle production out that way, a lot of chicken factories and things of that sort. So and most of the water out there is used for agricultural purposes and for ag production. So that bill is quite a significant step in the right direction, but nonetheless, it raises some serious questions about the future. And I also sit in the Agricultural Committee, and one of the things that I'm interested in personally, the state is obviously thinking about these things as well, and that is what crops might grow out there that require very little water, but would still provide livelihood to the farmers out there. Sorghum is one of the plants that is in which they've made some progress in terms of breeding plants that use relatively little water. Sorghum is a plant that goes dormant when it gets too hot, for example, and so is rather well protected against periods of drought. We are in Kansas in a sustained period of drought, I was just walking at the river, even here in the Northeast, the Kansas River, the other day, and I could walk on sandbanks for, a mile out, which is unbelievable. I mean, I haven't seen these kind of low water levels since I was a child. So it's pretty significant. Out west, it's terrible. But there are plants, for example, like sesame seeds. You find them on the bun of every Big Mac at McDonald's around the world, but they're all grown for the most part in Paraguay by Mennonite farmers. One could easily grow them in Kansas, in particular in those areas in which the drought is significant. Sesame seeds require almost nothing in the way of fertilizer or pesticides and very little water. And so that makes it very significant, particularly since the technique of making sesame milk has just been developed and is on the market in Canada. And that's significant because sesame is grown all around the world. Almond milk, for example, is highly water intensive. Sesame milk is not, and it has more protein. So it's a super crop to be considered in areas in which water is scarce. So that's one whole area, and maybe more than you want to know. But the other thing that's sort of significant in Kansas is that we are a high wind energy producing state. The state of Kansas probably ranks second or third now in wind power production, and I think 47% now of our state energy comes from wind energy. We are part of the Southwest Power Pool, which is a distribution network which reaches from the Canadian border all the way down to northern sections of Texas, in a corridor about as wide, and we move power around inside the power pool using the cheapest sources of energy first, and then moving to other sources of energy. So if there's an abundance of wind energy, we try to move that around to the folks that are part of the Southwest Power Pool, and then only do we move to non-renewables. And so that's been big in terms of keeping energy rates low, but also in increasing the amount of renewable energy that we use.
So thinking about learning from peers, are there any jurisdictions, states, or countries that you're looking at that have already had experience with, for example, expanding drought-resistant agriculture?
Well, we're lucky that we have a land-grant university, Kansas State, which is an agricultural university, a very fine one. And they're very heavily into research into different kinds of plants and crops being grown all around the world and how they might be modified. Their sorghum program, for example, is gaining quite a bit of traction in Africa, where they have partners and where they are working in order to help develop crops that will feed people in Africa with the scarcity of water that is also present there in many places. So there is a global kind of research network that the university that Kansas State University is part of, and our committee gets kind of regular updates about what's going on. Our ag committee gets updates about what's going on at least once a session in that regard. So there's certainly thought going into that. But you have to remember that in agriculture in the United States, a lot of it's driven by the kinds of subsidies given by the federal government. So, for example, you can have the bizarre situation in which someone in New Mexico tears up thousands of acres of desert land in order to plant corn, knowing full well that the corn won't grow. But because the crop insurance pays $200 you know, per whatever, you know, for that, it's 200. I can't remember what it is, whether it's an acre or whatever, $200 an acre for destroyed crops. Therefore, it was planted with the intention of simply cashing in on the crop insurance. This kind of bizarre policies that lead then to manipulation of this sort, which destroys natural land and puts into crops what should never have been put into crops. Somehow we have to find a way to address, I think, on the federal level, subsidies in ways that make sense going forward. I think obviously farm subsidies make a lot of sense. There's a great deal of climatic change, even without global warming, that affects food production, and so there's good reason for subsidies. But some of the subsidies tend to favor certain kinds of crops that don't seem to make a lot of sense now, and don't allow the kind of flexibility that we might need in order to think more about sustainable agricultural practices as well. And there's a great deal of conversation going on in the United States now about regenerative agriculture. I mean, agriculture is around the world is responsible to an even higher degree than industrial output for global warming. And so it's the agricultural discussion that generally receives too little public attention when it comes to greenhouse emissions and so forth. And so changing agricultural techniques to more sustainable techniques, to ways that preserve carbon in the ground, for example, is very, very important. Another area that we've been discussing here in Kansas is hydrogen. I know that that in Alberta, for example, as I learned on this trip, hydrogen production has been going on for at least 50 years, and we are late to this game. However, we see a great opportunity in hydrogen production in the state. We have unique geology in the south, overlapping with Oklahoma, underground salt caverns, which allow for the storage of hydrogen in sealed compartments, and this is significant because until battery technology becomes more reliable, you know, you can use wind energy to carry out hydrolysis and to create green hydrogen, and that hydrogen can be stored, and so that wind energy doesn't just simply dissipate somewhere out there. It can be stored, and it can be fed into gas lines, for example, and transported in other form, even exported to Germany, for example. Looks like you're going to have great hydrogen import needs, and it would. I'm sure there are many places in the world that are going to be lining up to produce enough hydrogen to meet it. But, you know, all of that said, so we applied to become one of the hydrogen hubs. And as you know, while I was with you, we learned that we were not selected as a hydrogen hub site in Kansas, but we were selected, which I did not know when I was with you, as an alternate. And because it isn't clear that those who have received the hub designation will in fact be able to carry out all the requirements that come with that designation, we don't see ourselves as out of the running yet. And so I think with or without that status, we are going to probably roll forward plans to develop hydrogen production here in the state of Kansas. So we'll definitely have a seat in that conversation.
Yes. So I would like to follow up on that. So first, sorry to hear that. Yeah, I read it also that Kansas wasn't selected to be one of the hubs. As an alternate, would that also mean a regional hub? Because in the end, it wasn't really state specific, but it was little segmented regions that would be the hubs themselves. Would Kansas then also, as an alternate, be part of a region?
So not as it's currently conceived, I think, but it could be. I don't know the details of that. We spent a lot of time and energy here in Kansas putting together a proposal for being part of that development. But, you know, one of the problems, you know, we just talked about water scarcity. So when you're making hydrogen, obviously you need water to do it. So what kind of water are you going to use? So the proposal from our state was going to use things like sludge and not fresh water and try to repurpose water that couldn't be used for anything else. So it was going to happen in the eastern part of the state, you know, in terms of production, where we have more water rather than, of course, in the western, where there is no water, so or very little. We'll see what happens with that. But I think there's enough interest in hydrogen production in the state that hub or not, we will be probably in the very near future producing hydrogen.
Since you touched on it, I would like to switch gears to talk about the Transatlantic Climate Bridge Study Tour. So in October, you and a group of six other state-level legislators from the Midwest, US and Canada came to Germany to learn about Germany's energy transition, but also with the aim of a two-way exchange where stakeholders you met also would learn from you. So can you talk about how your experience was? Anything that struck you or stood out to you about the rhetoric around climate policy or the approach to solutions and how this differs or aligns with what you see at home?
Well, you know, it's a very intense tour. I mean, we're exposed to an awful lot in rapid fire succession. I'm still not sure I've been able to even process half of what we learned while we were there. The thing that I think that struck me most, which is, of course, you know, Germany is a much different nation than the United States, and it seems to me that there's a great deal more unity in Germany around the move to the transition to renewable and sustainable energy sources. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. I think we discussed, you know, the resistance to nuclear power, you know, not only as a result of the rearmament debates of the 80s, which I can remember well, but also of Chernobyl. I was living in Germany during Chernobyl and was doing some translation work for the Umweltministerium in Bonn still at the time. And I think in a nation that has been through, you know, a terrible war and understands the horrible destruction of even so-called conventional weapons, it was very easy to imagine what nuclear destruction in the future might look like. We don't have that in the U.S. I remember, of course, when The Day After was filmed, the movie with Jason Robards that shows a nuclear blast in the Midwest, sort of a post-apocalyptic kind of film in that sense. It was filmed in Lawrence, Kansas, while I was a student at the University of Kansas. I remember coming out of class one day and all of these people bandaged and bloody walking around in front of the hall, Wesco Hall, where I was just coming out of a Greek class, thinking to myself, what on earth is going on here? They were filming the movie, unbeknownst to me, on that day among many. And I remember the night when the movie was first shown. I had finals the next day, so I went up to the library to study. But there was nobody on the streets at all. It was dead silence. Everyone was watching the destruction of their town in the future on TV. It was eerie, ghostly even. And I think, you know, but that sense generally, except for, you know, kind of in Hollywood fashion, you know, that something like that is possible, I think is largely absent in the American reality. And so, of course, nuclear energy is I don't think has had quite the has not created quite the anxiety in the populace that it has in Germany specifically, and perhaps in Europe generally. However, the other part, of course, is with the complexity of the organization of government in the United States, you know, with the federal and all these independent state levels, it's very hard to get anybody on the same train when it comes to things like a sustainable energy future. Everyone is moving at a different pace. Certainly, I would say in the central part of the United States, very different awareness than on the East and West Coast, where population density and energy demand and so forth makes it abundantly clear that something's got to change, and where I think the environmental environmental consciousness is more developed than it is in areas in which there's so much space that we just fail consistently to recognize how important it is to conserve what we have. You know, when we want a new house, we just go outside of town and build a new one, right? On land that is readily available for little cost, and we build out in the county instead of the cities. Well, that means that all of our cities are built around the availability of cheap oil. And so, you know, to get anywhere, you've got to drive, you know, 10, 15 miles to go shopping or do whatever. It isn't like in Germany where I could, you know, walk 15 minutes and get everything I needed for my daily life. Pretty much in my own neighborhood. I mean, it's very different, and so it's hard to organize public transit in when things are spread out over such a large space. And so, So there's a lot of I think resistance, even though there's recognition that at some point in time we have to move in this direction. So what was really striking about what we saw there was just how on board everybody was, both with the recognition that global warming is a thing. We have deniers in the United States who seem to think that this is just kind of silly, and that if you look at geologic history, well, this is all just a blip, and all the rest of it. We know, of course, from core samples from the Antarctic and whatnot, that this is very serious, and that we need to address it. But there are many who can still who still do deny it, and a lot of politicians who run on that denial because it promises that nothing will change in the status quo, and that of course is good news to the fossil fuels industry because they don't want to see their profit margins dissipate or give way to other areas of energy. But if you look at where the large oil corporations like Exxon are investing their money, you can see that they don't care how they make their money. And if sustainable energy is the future, by golly, they're going to be on the front end of that. And so I think it's difficult for the smaller oil producers to figure out what their future is going to be like, because they don't have that kind of, you know, Exxon can, you know, close down shop for 10 years and retool for something else. Local oil producers cannot. And so I think they're wondering about the revenue streams from their oil wells and so forth, and are wanting to be part of the conversation, but are not quite sure in what way they're going to be able to do that profitably.
So staying on environmental consciousness, how do you then talk to your colleagues on the other side of the aisle about some of these policy challenges? What kind of language is convincing? What do you think the best way to get bipartisan action on climate and energy policy is?
So in Kansas, I think the only way you can really have an impact on policy debates is to point to economic advantages. The values debate, it doesn't seem to get much traction among the broader populace here, unless you can point out the definite advantages in terms of prosperity. Our favorite word here in this country, you know, is prosperity. Everything's a matter of prosperity. And growth. Growth, of course, very important word. We worship that word. You know, all of these things which one could question, you know, the idea that we might need to learn to live with less is never much part of the conversation. So we seem to put all our faith in e-vehicles and things like that, as though that alone will somehow take care of all our problems. Well, they won't. Population's growing, the energy needs are growing, and we can move to sustainables all we want to, but unless we do something about curbing our insatiable desire for energy, we are going to, you know, continue down a very, very bad road. So right now, what one has to do is make the case that it is economically advantageous. And I think as far as hydrogen is concerned, and as far as wind power is concerned, even though wind power, for example, still has many opponents, I think most of the politicians understand that wind power is with us and here to stay, and that we need wind power. But as of yet, we also need backup sources of energy to maintain the grid. Wind power alone won't do it. So I think that realization has already come through. And certainly to those farmers and folks who have leased their land to wind power generational companies, they understand that the extra income that comes from that is good news indeed, especially in times when there's crop insecurity. So I think the primary way in which we talk about this is by trying to make a case for the economy of it. That seems to be right now the only way to make real traction.
And has there been efforts to sort of bridge this, as you said, maybe gap between those that actually that still deny the existence of climate change and those that are actively working on those deals that you mentioned and working on sort of framing this problem as one of collaboration? Are there any examples in the climate or climate policy domain of bipartisan collaboration that you could think of or that you've maybe experienced yourself?
Well, I mean, around wind energy, certainly, and around hydrogen, I can see great potential for collaboration. If you're asking about Kansas, Europe, or Kansas, you know, any other region, I think generally that isn't the case, but I would think that that at the executive level there are lots of conversations going on between different states. And I know our governor was just in Frankfurt, not just to see the Chiefs play the Dolphins, but also to have various conversations with economic and other partners. I don't know to what extent her conversations revolved around climate issues or sustainable energy. You may know more about that than I do. I know that when I was in the embassy, one of the ladies there who presented to us was going to meet with our governor around that football game. So I imagine that that there are conversations like that going on, but nothing of the kind, at least on a legislative level, that I'm aware of.
This is not a question, more of a comment, but it really struck me what you said about the farmers who maybe are having more trouble with their yields than also being able to diversify their incomes with putting wind turbines on their properties. It kind of ties everything together that you've been talking about. Not only looking for drought-resistant strains, but also just integrating climate and energy policy and agricultural policy in a way that is more sustainable, not only for the individuals, but also for the environment generally.
Perhaps you've already answered this question with this, but we have a segment that we do at the end of every single episode of this podcast where we ask our guest about a policy crush that they have. Essentially, this means what is a policy that you've seen implemented elsewhere and that you'd really like to see implemented at home?
You know, there's so many things that that I admire about Germany, and it's funny because the Germans complain about all the things I admire. They complain about high taxes. They complain about the medical system. They complain about the education system. I mean, no one can complain as professionally as a German. That said, having gone from living in Germany for 13 years and come back here, what's really striking is how excellent, for all its problems, the German healthcare environment is. It's so insecure in the United States by comparison, and we waste so much money here on middlemen and so forth that supposedly save money but really cost a lot of money. I mean, no one in the world pays as much money for healthcare as citizens in the United States do, and get far less of it and far less consistently and of a far lower quality on average than anything that you probably experience in Europe. At least that's my sense. I mean, we have so many people here who have no insurance and have no access to. I mean, yes, we have excellent facilities and we have the most modern treatments and yada, yada, yada. But they're only available to those who have enough money to access them or who have the insurance to access them. Otherwise, you can be ruined. And this is very different than what we see in Europe. And so I very much admire what the Europeans have been able to do in social policy. I wish we weren't such individualists and had a greater sense that there is a place for socialism, dirty word in the United States. There is a place for social solidarity when it comes to things that we all need. And it's not only healthcare that we need, we also need an education. And education is one of the things that that Germany also does extremely well. I had good friends who were plumbers. But what plumbers they were. They would come to the United States to visit me and we would travel down the highways and they would crawl into every gas station under the sink and look around at what kind of stuff they were installing and how the pipes were being put together. And they would shake their heads and say, good God, none of this would ever pass inspection in our country. And we complain about red tape here, but of course we also tear down everything after about 20 years and rebuild it new again. So we don't care about the quality. But in Germany, things are built to last. And of course, this too is a contribution to the sustainable energy problem. I mean, construction utilizes energy, right? If you build a house and it stands for a couple of hundred years, or in some parts of Germany, have been standing for, in the case of Fachwerkhäuser or mud and daub homes, have been standing for over 500 years. That's energy that hasn't been expended to build something new. It's certainly earned its keep, right? And this kind of, you know, sustaining the substance that one has rather than constantly building new things. and that when one does build new things, one tries to build them of a quality that that will last for generations. I mean, I think that's a completely different mindset, and it's one that is its own form of contribution to the whole question of energy conservation and expenditure. And I think in our sort of throwaway world here in the United States, we don't think about that.
That's certainly true. Germany has had a long record of sustainable practices from building to recycling. So that's all we have time for today. Tobias, thank you so much for joining us and talking to us today. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks also from my side for this insightful conversation. Thank you.
It's a real pleasure to speak with you both. Thank you, Lena, and thank you, Toby.
If you're still listening, I'm sure you want to learn more about the Transatlantic Climate Bridge. The Transatlantic Climate Bridge is a consortium of climate and energy think tanks, consultancies, and NGOs working to improve and coordinate climate policymaking between Germany, the United States, and Canada. At the head of our consortium is Adelphi, a Berlin-based leading independent think and do tank on climate, environment, and development. Adelphi and its partners run the TCB program office with the support of our funders in the German federal government. And our activities include writing analysis, putting on events, facilitating government dialogue, organizing exchange programs, and much more. So, that's it for our 9th episode. I'm Toby, signing off.
And I'm Lena. Thanks for listening, und bis zum nächsten Mal.